So the overarching theme of my research and so of this lecture is, of course, as Michael has already said, age-related change in everyday memory performance, and particularly changes associated with Alzheimer-type dementia. What I'm going to present tonight are some of the research that my group and myself have been doing over the years and some of the findings that we have made in this area. I use a wide variety of approaches, and so we're going to move from straight behavioural work through to brain imaging. So I hope I can keep you with me, and it's going to be a fairly swift tour. But I'm going to try and cover three parts, really, of the talk. There'll be three parts. What happens to performance on everyday tasks when memory fails? Some pharmacological strategies we can use to support failing memory, and individual differences that might influence the best choice of treatment for different individuals. Okay. So when we think of memory, we tend to think mostly of remembering. That is, what we did last week, last year, or what we might have to get from the shops next time we go. But in fact, that's only a very small part of memory. Memory's a lot bigger than that. And psychologists have been studying memory for decades, and as we always do, classifying it into different types. And really, there are three main types of memory that we use almost all the time. We have a language... Oh, sorry, I'm going to go backwards a bit on that one. Pressed the wrong button. We have a language lexicon, or a language store, or a lexicon. We have our own general knowledge system, and we also have a personal bank of memories and personal histories that we carry around with us. And we use these fairly seamlessly together, often making use of another type of memory, which is working memory. Working memory is a sort of online short-term processing unit that we have that allows us to hold in mind certain information or plans or tasks over a short period of time while we're currently working on them. And it's sometimes called the blackboard, our blackboard for current operations. And all of these memories are memories that we use almost all the time without even realizing it. So everyday tasks use all of these different sorts of memory, and yet we hardly ever even register that it's memory that we're using to complete them. As we get older, however, we know, and science tells us, that memory does get worse. And beyond the normal age-related changes in memory, there are certain diseases that cause chronic and persistent memory loss, and dementia is one of those. Dementia results from changes to critical brain structures, and the primary symptom of dementia, amongst others, symptoms that people have, is memory loss. So it's one of the areas that most interests people who are interested in memory research. It's in the news very often now, but when I began working on it over 15 years ago, it was fairly underpublicized and under-researched. We knew quite a lot about memory or models of memory and how memory worked in the average person, mostly actually an undergraduate psychologist, which is who we experimented on to produce most of the models of memory. But we really didn't know much about how memory failed. And for my first grant, I decided to write to the Wellcome Trust and ask them to fund a 5-year longitudinal study just charting, really, the breakdown of memory in people who had dementia over a 5-year period. Just a longitudinal study looking at what happened when memory failed and actually trying to understand it from looking at it. My very esteemed colleague, the late Professor Parkin, who wasn't known for his optimism anyway, said, oh, you'll never get that funded. Nobody will ever look at that. But we did. We did get it funded, and we produced some beautiful work. I'm going to start with that sort of work, a short review of that work today. The grant was essentially a study of tea-making, and that's because tea-making provides us with a beautiful model of everyday memory task. When we make tea, we actually use all of these different memory systems that we see here. We need to have we use our lexicon to identify the objects that we need to use. To make tea, we use our general knowledge as to how and when to use each item. And we use our personal memory for our particular idiosyncratic routine or for the layout of our own kitchens, for example. We have to use our short-term memory to hold all of this in mind and remember that we're trying to achieve a cup of tea. So it's a very good model that we can use. It's a complex task. It might seem simple, but it's a complex task. This complexity was something that we saw when we did a couple of studies with healthy volunteers making T2. And this next slide shows our own FRS, Mike Land here, wearing a very attractive head-mounted device that he devised that allowed him to look at his eye movements while he was making tea. And here in the bottom clip, you can see a cartoon of his eye movements. The dots are the fixations and the lines are the movements between that he engaged in simply to fill the kettle. Okay? So it's quite a tricky task, even for an FRS. So, for the dementia project, we worked with a small group of people with dementia who had a clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer-type dementia. We know that it's quite a muddy area. It's hard to get people with a clear diagnosis. But these were people who had probable Alzheimer-type dementia when they started off with us. They all lived at home with a spouse or a relative carer, and they were all in fairly good physical health. And we intended, by recruiting people early in the course of their dementia, to be able at the outset to chart for each individual their own personal protocol for making tea. So by doing this at the outset of the study, it meant that any changes that happened over time, we could categorise clearly against the types of errors, against their own protocol. So the types of errors they subsequently made could be catalogued against their own protocol. And we could unambiguously say that things had been lost from their routine or things had changed in their routine. Okay, obviously everybody has a different protocol for making tea, and here we have a couple of our individuals' personalised tea-making protocols. You can see that they varied quite a lot in the order and the number of actions even that they used to complete a cup of tea. Okay, so we have individual protocols established at the outset of the disease. We're looking to see how these change over time. We wanted to know what happened in a natural setting, so we turned up with our video cameras, we visited people in their own homes, and we simply asked them to make tea under certain different conditions, videotaped that performance, and analysed each of those videotapes for the presence or absence of the individual's personal actions for their usual routine. We wanted to know what happened as the memory began to fail. And so we asked them to make tea under four different conditions that would tell us about the types of cues and the way that people use their memory to support them as the performance changed. So, first of all, we simply asked volunteers to tell us how they made tea. This was sitting in the living room, no cues at all, so they weren't allowed to go anywhere near the kitchen, but they were asked to give us a verbal protocol of how they made tea normally. And this is actually not a terribly difficult task. Most people could sit down and give you a fairly easily could give you a description of how they do a particular everyday task. So it gives us a measure of how accessible memory is with no cues. Just how easy can you get at the memory for that routine? Second of all, we ask them to go into the kitchen and actually make tea. Okay, this gives us our primary measure, a direct measure of performance when there's the visual cues from their normal kitchen, when there's motor cues because they're doing it. So a good example of what memory looked like at its optimal level. We then had two other conditions that kind of that varied these two levels of cue. So we actually asked them to make tea in a new room in the house. We assembled their gear in a different novel setting and asked them to have a go at making tea. So we removed all their usual visual cues, but since they were still doing it, they had a motor cue there for them to help them along. And in the final condition, we asked them to instruct the researcher to make tea in the kitchen in an attempt to provide a condition where we had visual cues but no motor cues. So the cues that would normally be active if they were doing it themselves were not there, but they were actually in their kitchen seeing it being made in front of them. So these four conditions were conditions that we asked individuals to make tea under on each of our visits, or more or less all of our visits. And we made lots of visits. So over the 5 years, we had some 300 sessions of tea making with our volunteers, had a lot of tea. It's a tribute, though, to my research fellows at the time, well, Sam Hutton, who helped me at the beginning, and also to Lynn Shepherd, who did a lot of the work, that actually these wonderful volunteers did continue to make tea with us for five, and some of them over 6 years, actually. They stayed on the project, so it was brilliant. Okay, so we compared their performance with age-matched individuals who didn't have any diagnosed memory problem. But we were also aware that these individuals have damage to brain structures, and so we wanted to compare them as well with other individuals who have damage to the same structures, possibly acquired damage to those same structures. And at the time that we did this, there wasn't much work being done on everyday memory in dementia, but there was quite a lot of work on everyday memory changes in people with closed head injury, so people who had an acquired head injury and had lost the ability to perform everyday tasks. And this work was being done by Myrna Schwartz in the States. And she described a syndrome known as action disorganization in everyday memory. And in a bizarre sort of transatlantic twist, she was actually looking at coffee making and sandwich making. But it sort of relates to the same sort of issues, really. And you can see here on this pie chart data that she achieved from people with closed head injury, a stroke to the right hemisphere or a stroke to the left hemisphere. And you can see that all of these individuals, there's a common pattern of errors that they're picking up. The majority of errors in all of them are omissions, that is failing to complete an action that's normally part of that routine. But in addition, there was evidence for a set of errors that were somewhat more unusual from these volunteers. So there was a fairly significant number of what's called sequence errors, for example, where you add the milk to the kettle instead of adding it to the cup. Substitutions, stirring the cup with a fork, there was quite a lot of those in each of this group. Additions, that's blending two routines together. Spatial errors, such as holding the wrong end of the spoon. Or other unclassified errors. Those included things like using wrong quantities or failing to complete the routine to its goal. And you can see that these errors were a substantial amount. So the largest single category was omissions, but these errors were a substantial amount of the errors that were observed. And this led Myrna Schwartz to call this syndrome action disorganization, because it looked as if their memories had become fragmented. They were jumbled. And we wondered if we would see this in our volunteers who had dementia. I'm going to just show a couple of fairly simple graphs and a couple of clips of the actions that we observed. The clips, I should say at the outset, are clips that we have permission to use from the people who signed on at the beginning of the project and also from their spouses. And on there, they preferred that we didn't anonymize them, so they didn't really want their faces to be masked out. I mean, I think that's a tribute to them, but they said, no, we don't really want the faces to be masked. So occasionally you see faces of people who've also been doing work with me. But okay, so let's start with the data, though. Okay, this next slide shows simply a record of the kind of mean number of actions or percentage of actions recalled from their own protocol for volunteers over the years. We're going to do years 1 to 4 because we have data from everybody for 4 years and some people for a bit longer. But as you can see from this, age match controls were mostly at ceiling right the way through the process, so we won't talk about those anymore. But for people with dementia, verbal recall, even at the outset of the study, was really compromised. They were really unable to recall verbally their routines. They recalled about 30%. That means that they were omitting about 70% of the actions that they were normally completing as part of their routine. So their verbal memory was very compromised, and it got much worse. By the end of year 4, they were only recalling about 10% of the actions that were habitually part of their routine. So we can see here that if you were to assess somebody with a memory problem using a verbal task, you'd probably hugely underestimate their performance because it would look as if it was extremely poor. On the other hand, if you get them to, get them to make tea in the kitchen This is performed recall over the same 4 years. They're actually incredibly good at it. So when they've got the right cues, they were at the outset making very few errors. By year four, they were making quite a few more errors. But if you look at this, by year four, these individuals were moderately to severely dementing in some cases. They have virtually no verbal recall at all, but they're making tea pretty successfully. That means that the memory is still available to them to complete these routines. And we were putting them in a situation where they could make use of all of the cues that they needed to access and use that memory. And we know that they were using the memory as well very flexibly. They often reordered actions without any particular consequence. And also, as the progression and omissions became more and more frequent, we saw that, as this slide is going to show, it was the non-essential actions that disappeared first. Okay? It wasn't just random actions that disappeared, it was the non-essential ones, which meant that the essential memory for that task was still there and intact. So you can see that even when they are losing some of the actions and there are significant numbers of omissions, we still more or less get a cup of tea. So it shows us that the essential memory is intact and is not in fact fragmented in the same way that you see in patients with other forms of similar brain damage. It's also interesting that when we put them in a novel setting, it didn't really throw them at all. So they could make tea in any room of the house. It really didn't matter. Here you can see that they were slightly worse when they're in a novel setting, but not substantially so. And it didn't get particularly bad, even after 4 years. So it tells us that visual cues, or the usual visual cues they have in the kitchen, are not particularly central to recalling and retrieving that memory. So we can conclude then that... Oh, no. Okay, no. Sorry. Where was I going from there? I'm just going to look at my notes. Oh, yes. I was going to put in the fourth condition. I've forgotten that. Okay. So visual cue is not terribly important, but as we can see from this difference between performed and verbal recall, as the disease progresses, motor cues and motor memories are more and more important. Cueing memory through motor performance is a big part of what these people were doing. And this was particularly visible in our instructed recall condition. So the instructions that they had, they were taken into the kitchen, sat down aside, said, give me instructions, tell me exactly how you would make a cup of tea so that I can make a cup of tea for you exactly the way you do it yourself. Don't go too fast because I have to keep up. And I'm going to do everything as and when you tell me to do it. So we're trying to generate more verbal recall by letting them observe somebody making tea for them. Okay? And let's look at what happens. This is a difficult task for them to do. It's particularly difficult if you've got a memory problem because you have to engage with the other person. You have to coordinate the retrieved memory with the actions of the other person and in reference to a common goal. You have to acknowledge the role of that other person, engage in joint attention, and anticipate or reflect the other person's actions too as they are carried out. So not a simple task at all. This is a short sample of recall from one of our individuals over a period of months. The number of actions recalled. And here I've put the verbal recall, very compromised as we saw before, the performed recall, and here are the number of verbal instructions that could be generated if they're seeing the actions completed in front of them. A substantial increase in recall under these conditions suggests that just seeing the actions happening somehow tends to access memory differently. And we would suggest that it's accessing memory because they are empathizing, they are seeing the motor performance by somebody else, and it activates their own motor memory. And we think that that's a good explanation of this because when this individual gets stuck with the verbal recall, they often would intervene. So come forward and complete the next action that was needed before they stepped back. So they're actually engaging. It's like they've been watching the person making it. They can engage with the next action almost seamlessly before they sit back down again. So to keep the routine going, they would make these interventions. And these interventions increase as the severity of the memory loss increased. But they would certainly be a way that they used, a technique they used to keep the routine going as their memory failed. So I'm going to show you a little clip now of this happening, and you'll see what I mean.
Here?
Yes.
All right, that's on.
It's a very good thing that, you know, it does very quickly.
Okay.
And you know where you are.
All right.
Then the next thing is to get out cups and saucers.
All right, where do I get those from? Where do I get those?
I think this side here. No. Next one.
No, they're not in here.
There'll be another side. Yeah, no. It'll be marked anyway.
Okay.
So it must be that side. Oh, wait a minute. Look in that lid.
No.
Sometimes I put them in there for quickness. No, save me. That's rich.
All right.
I wonder where they are now. I think, you know, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Okay.
Go straight to the cupboard that they're in. So in other words, he knew where they were. The motor movement allowed him to find where they were immediately. The verbal instructions to generate that location were not there for him. So our work then, our observations tell us quite a lot of things. Apart from these little clips, a lot of other work was done on archiving these tapes and going over them again and again and again. And we could see that from the data that we obtained, everyday memory performance in people with Alzheimer-type dementia was very different from the sort of memory that we saw in closed head injury. The majority of errors that we saw over 5 years were omissions. Okay, they weren't these fragmented memories that we see here. They made very few, they very rarely made substitutions. They very rarely made blends between actions. They very rarely inappropriately used any of the items. They really had a problem mostly with maintaining the routine once they'd accessed it. So they could access the routine. The routine still seemed to be there, but they couldn't actually maintain it sufficiently to get to the end of it without omissions and errors. Okay, the ability and the difficulty with this sort of online monitoring is much more apparent if I show you a clip here. Thank you. We decided that we weren't going to get a cup of tea that day. Okay, so, but the important point, as I said, is that this is not bizarre activity. This is not misuse or misrepresentation of the or misplacement of objects. It's not inappropriate substitutions or blends. This is just failing to keep that routine activated long enough to get to the end of it. And so we really can conclude from a lot of our behavioural data that the memories that we are looking at here are not fragmented and they're not lost. They're poorly maintained once they've been accessed. And this gives us some indications as to how we might support memory and how carers can support memory at home, for example. It gives us quite positive and optimistic views of what possible interventions we could use. So, for example, we could engage motor memory more. We could encourage error monitoring. We could increase the cues at these points of transitions and when the activation becomes too low to move on to the next thing. So we've got, from this behavioural data, some good ideas of where to go forward and suggesting behavioural strategies. And in fact, we're now working again on this this project after a 10-year lapse with a new DPhil student, Sarah, and a very a studentship donated by Mr. Michael Chowin. So we've been able to sort of pick this up and we're moving forward now with work that we've done in the past and also the work that's been done in this intervening 10 periods to try and develop some strategies, some behavioural strategies to support independent living for these individuals in their homes. Now, moving on a bit, most people would imagine that they could anticipate some loss of memory with age. But maybe they would be surprised to know just how soon our memory begins to deteriorate. This next slide is some lovely work from Bob Logie and Liz Mailer. They ran this study through the BBC Science website, so they got this wonderful N of 300,000. So 300,000 participants for this study. To put it into context, most psychology studies run with about 20 individuals per group. So the data is pretty impressive, and it really shows us, well, it shows us two different types of memory and how different types of memory decline at different rates. The most sensitive to age-related decline, we've got age along the bottom here in just cohorts, is prospective memory, which we define in terms as the memory for appropriate recall of previously planned intentions. So, for example, I might make a prospective memory intention to pick up cash next time I go past a cash dispenser, or to put out the recycling before I go to work. So that's prospective memory, remembering something that we'd previously planned and when it has to be executed. Prospective memory is very sensitive to change, and rather depressingly, we can see that from about the age of 18, it's declining year on year, which is not great news. I'm sure that you can all think of examples, in fact, of your own prospective memory failures as I look around the age range of the room here. But at least now you know that you're not alone. The question, though, in everyone's mind when they see data like this is whether we could do anything to, in any way, postpone or reduce the prospect for age-related memory decline in older adulthood or middle age. And indeed, there's quite a lot of work now that shows that there are things that we can do. The way that we use our minds and our brains and bodies in our younger lives will certainly impact to a certain degree on the extent of memory deterioration that we can anticipate in older adulthood. And just to give you a few scientific studies that support the view that we need to watch what we're doing. This one suggests, for example, a Mediterranean diet is quite good for us. This one, you can choose your reading, suggests that a moderate consumption of Cabernet Sauvignon is quite good for us. This is a neat little study. In fact, the very lucky, it's a lucky lot of mice. This lucky lot of mice were encouraged to drink Cabernet Sauvignon over 6 months. It was Californian, apparently. And they were compared subsequently with mice who'd been exposed or who'd been encouraged, whose drinking habits had simply been lab alcohol. So the same concentration of alcohol, but just lab alcohol. And you can see this delightful picture. That this is a measure of the kind of damage to the brain, and the Cabernet Sauvignon group win out, hands down here. So you know what to drink. We also know that hypertension is a serious risk for age-related memory change. And in fact, 30 to 50% increases in your... You can reduce the prospect of moving into dementia in later years by about 30 to 50% if you treat hypertension. So untreated hypertension is a serious risk factor for dementia. The earlier that we can treat it, the better. And it has a significant impact on that age-related memory decline. It's an interesting balance, though, because we also know, in a project that I'm working with Juliet Wright and Phil Thompson at BSMS, we're looking at the negative effects of hypotension, which is a consequence of very aggressively treated hypertension in chronic kidney failure patients. So people who have chronic kidney failure, they're treated fairly aggressively for their hypertension. They become hypotensive, and in fact, they show memory decline too. So it's a very tiny balance between being hypertensive and being hypotensive. Both of them are not good for you. We also know that exercise is pretty good for you. There's a lot of evidence that suggests that looking after our bodies also helps our brains and our memories. And in fact, another study that we're involved in is a study with Naji Tarbit at the Sussex Partnership Trust and some sports physiotherapists in Brighton University looking at exercise in early dementia and whether or not it can stave off some of the cognitive deficits. We've also can look at cognitive training, which has been in the news, been on the television recently. And apart from the bad science, there is certainly some evidence, aside from the bad science, that these sorts of cognitive brain training opportunities can help in certain situations. And I've put this in for my younger members of the audience here, which this is a study that shows that just 10 hours of training on an action-based video game, 10 hours extra training on the Xbox, can significantly improve, for both girls and boys, spatial working memory. These are two different measures of spatial working memory. This is a usable field of vision measure, which is something about detecting targets and fairly related to the game, I think. But this is actually a measure of spatial working memory, quite different from what the kind of spatial working memory used in the game. And you can see that individuals who've been exposed to training on this Xbox game actually have an improved spatial working memory on both of these tasks, and more importantly, that benefit is sustained 5 months later. Here on the other side, we see the similar exposure to a non-action video game, Xbox game, no benefits to anything at all over time. So, you know, when I'm failing to limit my son's Xbox time, I can at least think that he's developing his spatial working memory. But brain training of this sort and behavioural strategies are fine in the early stages of memory loss, but they do require considerable time and effort and input from the individuals who are using them. And so it's not surprising that there's probably a fairly limited time frame over which those kinds of strategies can be applied and can effectively change memory. Because of that, and for the group of individuals who are experiencing significant memory loss, there's quite a lot of interest in other ways of optimizing or supporting memory, and certainly interest in pharmacological strategies and that's drug strategies for treating memory failure or memory decline associated with dementia. And this has all been really developed from much more basic science that looks at the way the neurochemistry of the brain and the way that the neurochemistry supports underlying memory processes. And now I'm going to move on to the next part of my talk, which is to look at pharmacological strategies and how we might use them to support memory. So alongside my work then with sort of free-range volunteers, as it were, I also run work in the psychopharm unit at Sussex, which involves studies looking at the neurochemical signalling that underwrites memory and attention. And in the lab, we can, of course, control much better the kind of experimental situations that we want to explore and the controls for the types of interventions that we might want to look at. And so we can look more carefully at what happens to the brain as we form and retrieve memories, and therefore how we might better stimulate them to work better. Memory, as I hope I've already convinced you, is not simple. And it is supported by chemical signalling. So memory is laid down by chemical signalling between neurons in a complex interaction across different brain regions. We can't see this when we just look at the outside of the brain, but we can see it if we delve deeper. We can see and we can now explore the sort of cellular basis for memory and memory change. And in this little clip, I hope we're going to delve down into the core of the brain. We're going to look at neurons. Now, neurons are the cells that we use to communicate within the brain. And neurons are activated when neurotransmitters or artificial analogs of those neurotransmitters lock onto the receptors on the end of the neuron and initiate chemical signaling to the next neuron. So they communicate by chemical signaling. essentially, because this chemical signaling system is one that we can interfere with, we can play with the extent of communication between neurons by interrupting or stimulating that chemical transmission. So, for example, if we block chemical transmission, we would expect there to be less transmission and less activation between neurons. And if we stimulate transmission, then we can increase the traffic between neurons. And if we know which neurons are particularly used in memory, then we can do that same thing to memory. Well, there is a number of different neurotransmitters are associated with memory and memory consolidation, but we know that there is one particular neurotransmitter that's critical to memory performance, and that's acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter that we have known for many years is essential to good memory, and we know this because of animal work, for example, in the 1970s, where if you block acetylcholine signaling in the brain, you actually interrupt and produce memory deficits in these animals. And if you stimulate additional release in acetylcholine neurotransmission, then you will increase or promote memory. And a lot of my work has been using those same kinds of approaches with healthy human volunteers. So how do we do this? Well, under fairly carefully controlled conditions, we can introduce compounds that change the level of acetylcholine signaling in the brains of individuals. They change the amount of acetylcholine released. They are transient changes associated with the compound that we're using, and the duration is simply for the duration that the compound remains in the brain. Okay? The work's done in a medically supervised unit, and we are obviously very careful about the sorts of volunteers and the contraindications and so on and so on. But we're also quite careful about the compounds we use, and we only use rather well-established compounds and compounds that we know are going to interfere reliably with our acetylcholine system to explore how memory is laid down and how we might therefore support and promote memory when it begins to fail. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter that has two particularly well-known compounds that change its level of signaling. The first is scopolamine, which is called also hyoscine hydrobromide, and it's the common ingredient of travel sickness tablets. Now, it's also an acetylcholine antagonist, so it blocks acetylcholine temporarily for a short period while it's in the brain. That means that we should expect it to produce memory deficits. And here's an early study that we did showing precisely that. The legend's not great here, but it doesn't really matter. Essentially, we have two groups of volunteers. They're completing three different memory tasks. These two tasks are somewhat more difficult, so their performance is worse. But the critical point is that pre-drug, these two groups of volunteers are matched in their performance. We give one group, ones with the dark dots, scopolamine, and what you find is that you can induce a temporary memory deficit in these young individuals. In fact, they perform at a level that might be more comparable with an older person. So we have a temporary and transient memory deficit associated with the blockade of acetylcholine signaling. Now, acetylcholine neurotransmitter has a very well-known compound as well that has the opposite effect. A compound that we know induces more acetylcholine release or greater levels of acetylcholine signaling and is therefore what we would call an acetylcholine neurotransmitter agonist is nicotine. Now, nicotine is able to boost acetylcholine levels because the acetylcholine neurotransmitter system actually has nicotinic receptors on its terminal buttons. So here's one of the neurons that we saw in the video earlier. Here's a magnified image of its terminal, And here there are nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. Nicotinic receptors actually exist all over the brain, I should say, on many of our different neurotransmitters, but they seem to have a particularly good role here on the acetylcholine neurotransmitter system. So here they are sitting there. When nicotine locks onto these receptors, it stimulates the release of naturally occurring acetylcholine, so it promotes the signaling between neurons. Here's a picture, just because it's possible now, to show the protein structure of this rather beautiful new receptor. That's a picture of its protein structure. So we're using nicotine in the lab to, in small doses, to promote acetylcholine signaling. And if it is, in fact, doing what we think it's doing, then we should be able to promote memory performance. It stimulates release of acetylcholine, and so we should be able to promote memory performance. And this is an example here that shows that this is what we can do. Individuals here were matched again on baseline measures, and then they were given a small controlled dose of nicotine before completing a memory task. In this instance, it was a prospective memory task, so it involved identifying infrequently occurring cues when they occurred, which had been set up earlier, and they had to remember later on in the session. And you can see that the individuals with the orange bars who received a dose of nicotine before doing this task actually performed around 15% better than a matched set of individuals who did not receive the same stimulation. In other words, it's evidence that we can, under certain controlled conditions, produce a pharmacological effect that improves memory performance in these individuals. Now, work in my lab over the years has done a lot of this sort of work and has shown that we can, by promoting acetylcholine signaling, actually produce effects on lab tasks that are mimicking or modelling a lot of everyday memory processes. So, for example, suppressing recall of task-irrelevant information, completing two tasks together, looking at effects of arousal on forgetting, and so on and so on. There are a lot of conditions attached to getting these effects of nicotine. The doses have to be very, very small, first of all. And so also, the effects are sometimes very specific. So, for example, in this particular study, looking at responding to peripheral targets, we compared nicotine, this is baseline followed by a drug. We compared nicotine with another stimulant, modafinil, which is often used by individuals who are working shifts. It's a stimulant and it promotes wakefulness. Now you can see here that relative to the placebo condition, nicotine has a bigger effect on this task than modafinil, which is another commonly prescribed stimulant. The effects are also, however, rather fragile. So in this next one here, you can see that a small advantage that was accrued on this prospective memory task by giving nicotine is in fact reversed when we encourage the individuals to become highly aroused before they did the task. So in fact they did, I think it was a stressful task, so it created a high arousal condition. And under high arousal conditions, nicotine actually has a much worse effect. So we can show from these various studies that very controlled, small doses of nicotine can produce better acetylcholine signaling, and this can sometimes produce benefits to memory performance. But the differences are quite small, they are quite fragile, and of course it goes without saying that if you take nicotine, for example, through the medium of a cigarette that you're all thinking about now, you not only would not get the sort of dose that you needed to improve memory, the dose would actually be somewhat too large, but you would also be taking on board something like 5,000 other compounds that cause you heart disease, lung cancer, and various other life-shortening conditions. So it's not that sort of nicotine that we're talking about. But we're talking about here a situation where we're learning whether or not we can control a neurotransmitter system and pharmacologically manipulate it to produce an advantage to performance, such as we might need for people who have serious memory failures. And indeed, this sort of work has stimulated a lot of work on precisely that kind of drug. All the currently marketed drugs for dementia are drugs which change acetylcholine signalling in exactly this way. And in fact, drugs which are specific to nicotinic receptor stimulation are being developed at the moment. So this sort of work is very important in understanding the neurochemical underpinnings of memory and how we might be able to tweak it, fine-tune it in some way. Okay. As medical science develops, we're all looking as well to drugs which are going to be good for us and which can be personalized to our own biology, to our own genetics. This has become a big issue. Pharmacogenomics is a big topic. Trying to personalize the treatment, trying to get the treatment just right for the particular individual. And what I'm going to talk about in the third part of my talk is some of the work that we're doing in our lab to look at that kind of interaction, to look at whether or not we're able yet to personalize treatments and to select treatments that might do better things for individuals with particular genetic or biological profiles. Apart from a very tiny 1% of individuals who have an inherited form of dementia, we really don't know who is at risk for dementia. We know that there are certain risk factors. So, for example, we know that if you give, if you have untreated hypertension, it increases your risk for dementia by about 30%. But there are many other factors that we don't understand. One additional factor that we're beginning to understand is a risk factor associated with about 15% of the population. And it's a risk factor associated with a small mutation in the protein that actually delivers and transports cholesterol around the body. This protein is called apolipoprotein E, or ApoE, and we know that it constitutes quite a big risk factor for dementia, in fact. ApoE is encoded on a protein, and everybody... There are three variants or alleles of the genetic bit of your makeup that encodes for this protein. These three alleles are called E2, E3, and E4. And everybody has two alleles in their genome. So they therefore have a combination, a pair of those three possible alleles. Most people in the population have a double E3. But some people have E4s, and E4s are not good news. These two different forms of the allele vary only in a tiny, tiny single amino acid here, okay? But that tiny difference confers a significant change in the way that the body deals with cholesterol and other proteins. So if you have an E4 allele, we know that your risk is increased for dementia because E3 alleles are good alleles. They improve synaptic repair, synaptic plasticity, cholesterol transport, and also help to clear a particularly problematic protein, beta amyloid, from the brain. On the other hand, if you have an E4, you have higher levels of beta amyloid aggregation, more tangle formation, more processing associated with amyloid overproduction, and more neurotoxicity. So in short, E3s are quite good and E4s are quite bad. And if you have an E4, either one or two, it increases your risk for dementia and also your risk for just poorer memory performance in older adulthood. So even individuals who don't subsequently move into dementia will have poorer performance if they have one or two of these E4 alleles. Okay, so if we summarise what we know about this genetic risk factor, we know that older E4s have poorer memories than E3s. We know that they also have poorer acetylcholine. And we hope I've convinced you that acetylcholine receptor stimulation can, in fact, improve memory performance in younger adults. So it didn't take much for us in the lab to put all of these three together and think, okay, what we need to do is to look at the combination of these and to see whether or not people with an E4 allele actually behaved in any different way from our general population with our receptor stimulation or our memory. And we simply asked two questions, really. Would young adults with E4 show deficits in memory? We know that as they're older, in older adulthood, they would show deficits in memory, but would they show deficits in memory in young adulthood relative to their E3 counterparts? And would acetylcholine receptor stimulation actually work to improve this group or not? Could we actually show any differences? Okay, so I'm going to take you through the study in a bit more detail because it gives you a flavour for the sorts of designs and the way that we set up studies in the lab generally. So here we have the typical sort of design of a study. We had 156 individuals who were genotyped. These were young adults aged between 18 and 30, non-smokers, normal BMI, and in good health. We always work with non-smokers, by the way, because we don't want any association with other forms of nicotine delivery. We had to genotype 156 because, as I said, only about 15% of the population have an E4 allele. The majority of the population have E3s. So from this 156, we were able to identify 27 individuals with at least one E4 allele, and we randomly selected 29 from the rest of the sample who had a double E3 to be our controls. As usual in these studies, we then randomly allocated individuals to receive either the active treatment, in this case, again, a small delivery of nicotine, or a placebo treatment. And we do it in a randomized, double-blind way so that neither the researcher nor the volunteer knows at the time that they're taking the compound, which of the compounds, whether they have an active or a non-active compound. And as usual, we delivered the compounds through nasal sprays. The nasal sprays are quite interesting. They deliver a small dose of nicotine very rapidly to the brain. They also are available to us in a way that allows us to have a very good match between the placebo and nicotine. If you deliver nicotine, nicotine has a very peppery flavour. It's very hard to disguise, but we have matched placebos that are matched in terms of those sensory characteristics so that they actually add capsaicin to the placebos so that individuals can't tell whether they've had nicotine or not. And just to prove that, this is the data from the volunteers who took part in that study, and you can see that we asked them after they'd completed the study whether or not they thought they'd had nicotine in their spray, and you can see that which way I want to do this. So 13 of those who believed that they'd had placebo had actually had nicotine. There we are. There I answer I am. And 15 of those who believed that they'd had nicotine actually had placebo. So the bottom line is that they can't tell. These drugs, these sprays are matched very well for the sensory characteristics, so they can't tell which they've had, which means that we don't have any expectations or other effects limiting our data. Okay. So, what did we do with them? We matched them on baseline measures on physiological characteristics such as blood pressure, heart rate, body mass index. On their health characteristics, they were all matched, the two different groups. And they were matched on sort of pre-screened cognitive performance such as estimated IQ and self-assessed cognitive function. We then gave them a series of cognitive tasks before and then after taking the spray. And in fact, today, just because I don't have a huge amount more time, I'm actually going to talk just about one task, prospective memory. Okay, this task is one that we really like. It's one we developed in the lab. We've developed it as a prospective memory task that we can use with people who have dementia, people who are just older, or people who are young. They all can do the same task. The task is set up as follows. We have a simple working memory task, which involves card sorting. So cards appear on the screen, on the computer screen, they flip over, and they simply have to say, they have to press one button if it's a heart, one button if it's a spade, and to withhold their response if it's a club or diamond. Okay, so that way they're actually moving quickly through this card sorting task. So if they see a sequence like this, they're going pressing the spade button, the heart button, no button, heart button, no response. And we can do as many iterations of this deck of cards as we want to. They do this before using the nasal spray. Then they're given a prospective memory intention to hold. Next time you do this task, in addition to sorting the cards, anytime you see a number 7, I want you to press a different button. That's the space bar. And this is setting up a prospective memory intention that they've got to flag the 7s whenever they see them. This is equivalent to me saying, okay, I'm going to put this letter in my bag, and when I see a post box, I'm going to stop and post it. Okay? It's flagging the intention to do something later in time. So it's a lovely little prospective memory twist. Okay, so they're sorting their cards, and if they see the set, this is what they have to do next time. Okay, so this is a spade. This is a heart, but it's also a 7, so they've got to press the space bar. No response, no response. A heart. And this is a club, but it's also a 7, so they don't have to withhold a response. This time they press the space bar. So they're going rapidly through this. They're making these decisions rapidly, but they're also keeping a prospective memory intention in mind and trying to do the two tasks together. What were the results? Well, the results were very interesting. First of all, our E4s outperformed our E3s on every task that we gave them. So here, I mean, these differences were all significant, even though they look small. Here, they were faster sorting the cards before they received the compound. And when they received the compound, not only did they keep an advantage to performance, but that performance got even better when we gave them nicotine. So the black bars are individuals receiving nicotine. These are the E3s and E4s. And the white bars are those receiving placebo. So basically, we had a double effect here. The E4s were better than the E3s. The E4s, for whom in older adulthood we can readily anticipate memory deficits, were better in younger adulthood. And the nicotinic effect was potentiated in this group. It's something of a paradox, then. I'm sorry, I'm running horribly over time. Can I keep going? I'll try and speed up. Okay, so we have some data from imaging studies that might help us to explain this rather bizarre paradox. And that's what I'm going to look at now, and I'm going to miss that one. Imaging studies tell us quite a lot about the brain. They allow us to, via sophisticated technologies, look inside the brain and to decide and to look both at its structure and also at the activity that that's going on in the brain in response to particular tasks. This is a facility that we now have to do, Sussex. We have a clinical imaging sciences centre. I think I've got that right. And so we can do this kind of thing online here. I'm going to start this again, if I can. I'm going to just start this one again because I want to say that this brain is one that I prepared earlier. It's actually a brain I prepared 24 years earlier because it's my daughter's brain, who very generously gave up her holiday vacation to do a pilot study for us. So this very beautiful brain is going to be my model to explain briefly now, as I'm running out of time, what we think is happening. So these E4s, as I said, are individuals for whom later in life we can anticipate memory deficits, but they were better on all of our tasks. How do we explain it? Well, imaging data tells us that the areas of the brain associated with memory in people who have an E4 allele in older adults tend to be underactive. So they're no longer activating their brains. In our task, it's the frontal region. So that area is underactive in older adults with an E4. In younger adults with an E4, this area is overactive. And we think that it's actually conferring an additional boost in young life. Okay, you've got greater activity, it can be harnessed for the task that you're doing, and so you get like a super boost when you're a young E4. This is an effect, it's kind of like the brightest candle analogy. This E4 advantage in young life results in burnout in later life. Okay? We also think that what's happening is that the nicotinic effect is particularly important in this group because it's actually affecting a different region of the brain. In our volunteers, the parietal, in all volunteers, we think that it's the parietal regions that are stimulated by nicotine. This area is connected to the frontal lobe so that we can see it has a beneficial effect, engages attention, the frontal lobe then comes in, and the super boost that we're getting in the E4s results in a synergistic effect of those two areas. So we're getting this sort of double whammy effect for our E4s, which is not there for our E3s. It's an interesting hypothesis, and it's one that the BBSRC has generously agreed to fund so that we can see if it really is true. We have begun work on this project, begun the recruiting and so on. We hope to demonstrate that this model actually does explain the paradox that we found already in the lab. And I'm just going to finish very quickly with a little bit of pilot data because it's quite exciting. This pilot data is from individuals, young individuals, who have come along and they've done the PM task in the scanner. And these are regions of the brain that lit up in response to the PM task. And we're very pleased to see that, just as we expected, they are frontal regions that are lighting up and also some parietal regions. That's exactly what we'd expect from that task, and that's exactly where we see these overactivity of E4s in the E4 brains. And we're also delighted to find that actually when we look at the nicotinic effect in the pilot, then it's the parietal areas that are lighting up there. So this is very neat and very exciting data, and we now have the challenge of rolling that out into a full project looking at nicotinic stimulation, genotype and memory. So that's where we're going in the future. I'm sorry I have run over time a bit. I hope that I have, that it's been of interest. I hope that I've persuaded you that we can explore memory in lots of different ways and that we can generate some really interesting interdisciplinary connections between these areas. By studying behaviour, we can develop and understand how memory works in real life and develop effective strategies to support independent living when memory fails. By pharmacological strategies, we can tap into and possibly fine-tune the neurochemical signalling in the brain to improve memory. We can look at individual differences in genetic makeup and possibly help to determine which of these will benefit most from what type of, from different interventions and how we can fine-tune those systems. And we can use functional and structural imaging studies to further our understanding of the neural mechanisms behind memory. And I hope that in this way, we at Sussex will be able to contribute to the increasingly urgent need to find a way through with memory deficits and to find a way through to help and support individuals who have to live with failing memories in older adulthood. And it remains just for me to thank all the people who have contributed in various ways to the work that I've done and the work that my group has done so far, the large number of public and charitable funding agencies who supported our work. Also, you know, in true Oscar fashion, I'd like to thank my family and friends and everybody who's come here to listen tonight, and to my two children, Jack and Annie, who've been brilliant, and to Michael O'Shea, my husband, who's my rock. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening.